Hello and welcome to the American Compass podcast. My name is Oren Cass. I'm executive director at American Compass, and this is Critics Corner, the fan favorite feature where we bring on vicious critics of American Compass to discuss our work. Although in this case, we have an especially special episode for you all in which perhaps I am the vicious critic, or maybe we can viciously criticize each other. But I'm delighted to be joined by Ovik Roy. Ovik is president of the Foundation for Research on Equal Opportunity. He is the policy editor at Forbes, and particularly germane to today, he is a convener of the Freedom Conservatism Statement of Principles. Ovik, thank you so much for joining.
Oren, it's great to be with you. It's been way too long.
It has been, and I was doing like the run back through my head. I mean, we worked together on the Romney campaign back in 2011, 2012. You were one of the people who taught me healthcare policy. We were at the Manhattan Institute together for a while. We've crossed paths since you've been down in Austin. You were very generous to host an event when my book came out.
Great book.
And
still a fan of it.
Thank you. Appreciate it. And I've always been very interested, certainly in the work at, is it FreeOp or FreeOpe?
FreeOp.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'll stop calling it FreeOpe.
We tried to get FreeO, and then, you know, there were those domain names were taken, and it was, but then we went FreeOp and that seemed to work, but convincing everyone how to spell it correctly is challenging. So that's just life. You gotta just build a brand and teach people how to spell it. But
exactly. Well,
I'm pretty familiar with that problem with a name like Ovik that's spelled AVIK. So I know that one
took me a while too, I will admit, but, no, I mean, obviously you've done that with FreeOp and now with the FreeCons, or FreeCons, as some say. Lots to get into, but would love to have you just start by talking a little about sort of what prompted the project, what were you sought to achieve, and why you felt it was necessary.
Well, you and I started our own think tanks right around the same time. So we started FreeOp in 2016, and I believe, did you start American Compass? What year was that when you started?
Or 2020.
2020, okay. So not exactly the same time. But, you know, I think similar intellectual journeys in that we both, in different ways, felt that the Republican conservative policy consensus was flawed. And I think a lot of we see a lot of the same problems in America today, and we're both kind of pointing at. And for me, a lot of it comes from my work in healthcare reform. So after our time in the Romney campaign, you know, a lot of people asked me after that election, okay, so now that you're this Republican healthcare guy, what should we do now that Obamacare is going to become the law of the land? You know, as you'll remember, and some of your listeners will remember, the law, the Affordable Care Act, was passed in 2010, but it didn't actually become law in terms of the regulations going in and the subsidies going into effect until 2014. So there was this window, if Mitt had won in 2012, where you could have repealed Obamacare and come up with a different solution to the problem with a kind of a blank slate in that regard. But once the law was going to be implemented, it's just very hard to unwind those kinds of very big laws that get involved in a lot of different things. And my answer to that question of what should we do now was pretty simple. It's we should embrace the cause of universal health insurance and show how free markets and competition and innovation in the private sector can deliver it. Other countries around the world have delivered universal health care in that way. I often point to Switzerland as an example. There are many others. It's not just single payer or the status quo. There are all these other ways to achieve a better and more affordable and more accessible and higher quality healthcare system than the one we have. And I ran into a lot of resistance in the Republican Party on that. Basically, people were saying, no, we're gonna win in 2016, and in 2017, we're gonna repeal Obamacare. I'm like, you're not gonna be able to do that. You don't have 60 votes in the Senate. You need 60 votes in the Senate to repeal Obamacare. You can repeal the tax increase and the subsidies, but the regulations are a big part of what to make Obamacare work. And you're not going to be able to repeal that. There's a bunch of things that you can't do just with 50 votes in the Senate. But I think a lot of people were afraid to admit that out loud because they were afraid they'd be kicked out of the conservative club if they said that, or maybe lose their donors or what, I don't know. But I'm like, this is just stupid. You know, we're going down this track where we're telling members of Congress and presidential candidates that you should lean into full repeal of Obamacare and a full replacement when you don't have 60 votes for that. And so I realized very quickly in 2012, 2013, that in this big country of 330 million people, nobody else was trying to solve this problem of how would you have a more private sector, pro-choice, pro-competition, pro-innovation approach to solving the problem of unaffordable health care, unaffordable health insurance, and especially the fact that the deficit and debt are driven by growth in government spending on health care. One thing that a lot of people don't appreciate is that we actually spend more per capita on government health care than any other country in the world by a wide margin, even though there are people who are uninsured in America. So that's how profoundly expensive and inefficient our system is. So I spent the next 2 years when I was still at the Manhattan Institute saying, okay, I'm not going to go back to Wall Street. I was previously a Wall Street guy working at Bain Capital, among other places. I'm going to take another 2 years to build this health reform plan that could at least conceivably pass Congress because it's politically engineered to anticipate and understand the nature of the system that we have today, build from there, iterate from there, not be too disruptive, et cetera, have a long-term vision of how to evolve the system in a better way. We published that in 2014, and then a number of the 2016 candidates called and asked for my advice, and I worked with a number of them. I worked with Rick Perry, the governor of Texas. That's what brought me to Austin. I worked with Marco Rubio, then the senator from Florida, still senator from Florida. And then after Rubio dropped out, I'm like, well, my side of part of what I did with Perry and Rubio is a little different than when I was working with you with Mitt was I was a healthcare guy with Mitt, but with Rubio and Perry, I was a generalist. I was working on a broad range of policy areas. And part of that came from the fact that I had this position at Forbes as the opinion editor, policy editor now, where I was getting a lot of the incoming ideas from the think tank community and a lot of these different areas. So I was learning a lot about some of the most creative and interesting ways to solve a lot of the problems I care about around how to use economic and individual freedom to solve the problems of social mobility. And that's what I led then leveraged and developed in these new roles in the 2016 election cycle. But in that race, obviously that race got overtaken by a different debate, which is, well, there were a number of debates, but one of the debates that was very important in 2016 was not related to economic policy, I would argue. It was related to, is the Republican Party going to be a party that's about a tribe and fighting for a tribal interest, or is it about everyone's interest? Are we trying to actually make America better for everyone? And I very much believe that the future of conservatism, of the Republican Party, of the values that I believe in were contingent on, and our ability to have a governing majority was built on whether or not we could show that those values could help everybody. If you can't make everyone better off in a free economy, then we don't deserve to have the political mandate to have a free economy. So that to me was really important. I feel like we're losing rising generations because we haven't done a good enough job of fighting the fights that matter to people who are on the bottom half of the economic ladder. And that doesn't just mean by income or wealth. It could also mean people who are just starting in their careers and haven't built up the advantages of someone who's been working for 40 or 50 years. There's lots of different ways to slice the data, but there are a lot of problems right now in America. And I think where you and I differ is that I think with FreeOp, what we're trying to do is we're trying to solve those problems by deploying more liberty and more economic freedom. And I think, obviously, you've expressed a lot of skepticism at the role that more freedom and more free enterprise, more economic freedom can play in addressing these problems. So that's where you and I may disagree. But I think we agree on a lot. I read through your Rebuilding Capitalism manifesto the other day, which I enjoyed. Found some things to agree with, found a lot to disagree with. But I'm sure we can talk about that as well. So then just to bring it to your most present question, which is what led to this this effort to launch Freedom Conservatism, that came from, as I've talked about in a number of the interviews from people who've asked, a concern that I have that a lot of people had that that instead of taking the approach that FreeOp has taken, where we say, let's try to solve these problems, these economic challenges that lower and middle income Americans have through pro-free market, pro-freedom solutions, there is an energetic group, which you're a part of, that says the opposite. It says, no, the problem is we have too much freedom, and that's an outdated philosophy. And so that debate, I think you guys have done a great job, and others who are allies of you have done a great job of organizing the group of people who feel as you do to influence the debate, particularly in Washington. And we felt that it was important for those of us who believe in free enterprise to do the same. And we were able to collect a pretty cool group of people, both people who've been around for a long time, like you've noted in some of your columns, but also some young people who are the whippersnappers in the future of the movement, who are also very much energized by what we've put together here. And we're obviously just getting started. We put together the statement of principles, which people can take a look at freedomconservatism.org. And the goal is to continue to build this network, just like you have and others have on your side of the debate, to show that economic freedom and individual freedom can solve the problems that Americans are faced with today. And one thing that I'll mention that I think is really important that was not noticed by your Financial Times column where you said all sorts of terrible things about us was that in the document we made a point to commit ourselves to certain policy agendas. So we didn't just say here's what we stand for. In three distinct places, we said we commit to an agenda that does X. The first commitment is to addressing the challenges of social mobility, especially cost of living, using free market solutions. The second is the deficit and the debt, having a constructive agenda towards addressing the deficit and the debt, which I know in your column you said, well, that's a pretty generic thing to say. You could say that, but in the National Conservatism Statement of Principles, there's no mention at all of the deficit and debt. So I would say actually emphasizing that it's an important priority is actually pretty important in this political climate we find ourselves in. And then the third is true racial equality. And that means no discrimination on the basis of race, but also recognizing that the downstream effects of slavery and segregation have resulted in a persistent inequality of opportunity that we as freedom conservatives ought to have an agenda to address. So let me just stop there because I've gone on for a bit and fire away.
No, that was a terrific overview. And I think, I'm glad you I think rightly emphasized, well, unsurprisingly given the name, the concept of freedom. Because I think in general, I would say you kind of characterized the state of play quite well. I would very much disagree with the way that you framed the debate as between those who want more freedom and those who want less freedom. Certainly from my perspective, that is a more question-begging assertion, and we land ourselves back at a conversation of both what freedom means and how we protect and preserve it. I think as you alluded to, I wrote a column very critical of the statement of principles and panning it as what I called Seinfeld conservatism, because it struck me that it didn't say much of anything. That is, it seems to me that a significant piece of that 2016 problem that you were describing was that we had reached a place where the quite consistently delivered rhetoric of the Reagan coalition had really lost contact with a lot of the problems we had and with useful solutions. And so I'm very open to whatever one's agenda is that is a better effort to engage with those problems and deliver solutions. I get very frustrated when I get to the end of the document and don't feel like I know any more about what the solutions might be than when I started. And so would love to kind of dive into a few of these and it sounds like from your perspective there are kind of clear commitments in them. So I think it'll be interesting to talk through some of those. But let's pause a moment on the word freedom, because I'd actually highlighted this. It's right there in the first of your principles under the heading liberty. You conclude political freedom cannot long exist without economic freedom. And so what I would be curious about is sort of what definition of what does economic freedom mean to you, and in what ways do you see someone like me calling for less of it?
Well, I think there's a bunch of points you made in there. Let me try to address as many of them as I can. So the first point I make is this is a statement of principles. This is not the Heritage Foundation's 1981 mandate for leadership, the phone book size thing with their entire agenda on it, right? That's not what this document is meant to do. It's meant to organize people around a core set of principles. It's not meant to be a policy manifesto. If you want to see policy manifestos, go to freeop.org. We got plenty. I mean, you know, one of the things you mentioned in your FT column was, well, you know, there's nothing here about how you would actually go about reducing the deficit. Well, I mean, if there's one thing anyone should know about me, especially you, Oren, is that I have no shortage of thoughts on how to reduce the deficit. And I've done arguably more work than anybody in our movement to try to seriously address the core drivers of our deficit and debt, which again is government healthcare spending. So, there's 75 think tanks represented by the signatories on the Freedom Conservative Statement of Principles. So if people want to find ideas in among the signatories, they're there. And I want to emphasize also, I don't know if I mentioned this in the beginning, is that I don't speak for all the signatories, right? So there's lots of different people who sign onto this thing because, again, the point of this is to create and build the kind of cross-sectional group that can possibly represent a majority coalition for freedom, right? So there are going to be people who have different points of view on all this stuff. There are the people that, you know, you would say are market fundamentalists and libertarians and blah, blah, blah. And there are people like me who, again, are not, I think I would call myself somebody who believes in free markets, free enterprise, but also sees a legitimate role for government in certain ways, which we can get into. So there's a range there, but the core principle is that wherever possible, wherever feasible, we should recognize that individual and economic freedom are core values that America has, with the notable exception of slavery, always tried to stand for. And those values have served us well. They're the reason why we are living in the wealthiest country in the history of the world, at least up to now.
Well, so back to the economic freedom definition then. How do you define economic freedom within that rubric, and particularly as something that you see someone like me wanting less of?
I think that first of all, we allude not directly, but I think all those of us who sign this document all understand individual liberty and economic freedom in the context of the thinking of classical liberalism, right? Negative rights versus positive rights. So negative rights meaning the rights that you have in terms of where the government shouldn't interfere with your freedom to act, right? Which is at least classically how the Bill of Rights in particular is understood. So economic freedom involves the freedom to own property that can't be taken away from you arbitrarily, to exchange that property or other goods and services for things that you want, to be able to build businesses or to engage in commerce in ways that you see fit, to be able to keep as much of the income you earn as possible, not have it taken from you by the government. Now, again, these are not, from my point of view, absolutes. I'm not one of these people on the libertarian side who say taxation is theft, though maybe there are signatories of our document who would say that. I think there is a role for taxation in any functional nation, in any functional society. But limited government, as we often like to talk about it in classical liberalism or even conservatism in America, involves really understanding that wherever possible, we should be trying to respect the autonomy of individuals, of families, of communities. And second of all, leaving aside that first principle, I would use a more empirical argument that freedom works, that when you actually trust people to make the decisions for themselves and their families and their communities, you have a much more dynamic, high growth, high wealth society that works for the most people. When the government runs most of the economy, you see less income, less wealth. I mean, that was what the 20th century was all about, right? The natural experiment of looking at West Germany, which was not a libertarian utopia. It was a social democratic country, comparing it to East Germany, which was more prosperous. Which is more prosperous, South Korea or North Korea, right? We have these natural experiments where you can control for things like cultural capital and say what economic policies worked and which ones didn't. And in every case, the countries that had a more market approach where people had more individual and economic freedom, they worked. And what I see when I read, you know, your manifestos, your documents, and also your social media feed, where you never miss a chance to attack what I would argue is a straw man of what you call market fundamentalists or libertarian dogmatists or zombie Reaganites. Or they're great phrases. As a writer, I appreciate the turn of phrase, but are they accurate representations of what people like me are advocating? No, they're not.
Okay, well, I guess, implementing a new Critics Corner policy that I won't try to ask a question more than three times, but I'll take a third pass at it.
If I failed, I'm not trying to evade your question, so tell me what you want
well,
me to
Well, you know, as I mentioned, I think you framed this up front as you saw yourself and other signatories wanting to advance greater economic freedom and folks like myself and with our agenda mm-hmm. wanting to constrain economic freedom. And so I'm still left wondering what is the way in which you stand for greater economic freedom and I stand for less economic freedom?
Well, we can just go through some of the things in your Rebuilding Capitalism manifesto here and kind of like just very quickly do a little drive-by here. You know, where are you on trade, right? You want the government to have much more control over trade. And I would agree that we need to be much more serious in addressing China specifically, because China is an adversary that is trying to militarily and economically defeat us and oppress its neighbors. That's a specific situation where I think we have a lot of agreement. But more broadly, the skepticism about free trade I find very striking and frankly destructive, because you know, you're a guy who's often said, you think that people need to get over their obsession with cheap stuff, quote unquote, because protecting American businesses from competition is more important. I don't agree with that at all. I think Americans are very capable of competing with the rest of the world. We're the second largest exporter in the world. It actually matters to blue-collar workers in America if they can make things that can be exported to the rest of the world. So we need to actually increase trade. We need to export more things because that's better for America. And if we restrict trade with our allies and our neighbors and the people who actually engage in, honest trade practice with us, that's a problem. To give one example. And so, you know, you might say, well, where that's a specific thing. Like, look, I grew up outside of Detroit. I grew up in the 70s and 80s with all of the protectionist stuff. You know, you describe yourself as a new right, but it's really, these are very old policies. Mandatory, you know, a percentage of product, or, you know, the components made by U.S. manufacturers, the tariffs, all the stuff. We did that with cars, you know, because the Japanese were eating our lunch, because we were making cars that weren't as good for various reasons we can get into. Detroit still went bankrupt, right? The big three still went bankrupt, or at least two out of the big three went bankrupt. So that's one area, that's trade.
Let's pause there. I mean, I think the trade one is a great one because, I mean, I'm struck by a couple of elements of it. One is that, you know, you take a country like South Korea, which I take it you see as a harbinger of or a representative of relatively greater economic freedom. I mean, I think South Korea's stance toward free trade is certainly much more restrictionist than anything we've proposed at American Compass. But more so to your point about sort of who is the old right or the new right. It was certainly the American tradition up until the past 40 or 50 years to have quite high tariffs and a protected domestic market. And so when you say political freedom cannot long exist without economic freedom, I guess I'm just very perplexed by how or why tariffs or protection of the home market would fit into that when that was in fact a core commitment of certainly Republicans and Americans generally in the founding generation up through Abraham Lincoln and most of those who I imagine you would also cite as great defenders of both political and economic freedom.
First of all, I completely agree that you're right that that the economic policies that you've been advocating on trade and a lot of other things are actually very old ideas. They're not new ideas at all. They're not novel. They actually bring us back to 19th century and early 20th century Republican economic policy. This was basically from the foundation of the Republican Party to World War II. This is what Republicans stood for. They stood for protecting business interests, It was an elitist policy, right? So Republicans were the allies of businesses who wanted their businesses protected from competition. And it was the Democratic Party, the populist party, that said we're for free trade because restrictions against trade, first of all, make our cost of living higher as ordinary people, and also because a lot of Democrats were farmers and exports were very important to farmers. And so the agricultural industry was really harmed by the high tariff policy of Republicans. And the economy was as well. And so since we moved to a more free trade approach, American prosperity has exploded. Yes, we have our challenges, which we can definitely get into, and you and I would agree on what those challenges are. And I, for example, totally agree with you that we should never have given most favored nation status to China. That was a huge mistake. We should have been much harder, had a much higher threshold, and even possibly never admitted China to the World Trade Organization because they're cheating. They're stealing our IP. Their approach to our ability to invest in their market is completely one-sided. The way they use their authoritarian methods to basically affect the United States through business interests is completely corrupt and terrible. So all this to say that the Chinese approach, again, completely agree that that's a huge problem. But when it comes to free trade overall has been a huge boon to the United States. We're the second largest exporter in the world, second only to China. So, you know, you talk a lot in that section of your book about the trade deficit, but the trade deficit is a relative number, right? So the trade deficit is your imports minus your exports minus your imports. But is it better to have, let's say the trade deficit is constant, is it better to have less imports and less exports, or is it better to have more imports and more exports? In other words, what about the absolute level of trade? Right? And the absolute level of trade is an index of economic freedom. And I agree that we should try to reduce our trade deficit. That's actually economically important. You know how we can do that? You know what the top four, three of the top four things are? You know what the top four things are we export? It's petroleum, it's crude oil, it's natural gas. It's like basically it's energy and then pharmaceuticals. Branded pharmaceuticals is number three. So like you want to export, want to reduce our trade deficit? The simplest way to do that is to eliminate all the shackles. Again, expand economic freedom, eliminate all the shackles that prevent us from exporting our energy to the rest of the world. We have enormous energy supplies and reservoirs that we could be sending to the rest of the world. Until very recently, thanks to a lot of these old style policies that you're talking about, it was illegal for the U.S. to export energy to the rest of the world. We finally fixed that thanks to those Paul Ryan Republicans that you're always bashing. And now we can actually export energy to the rest of the world. And that's done a lot to massively improve our balance of trade because, again, three of the top four categories of our exports are energy related.
Well, I'm actually surprised and delighted that we agree on the importance of reducing the trade deficit. And I think that's something that, you know, as we've emphasized, other things equal, a high level of trade can be much better than a low level of trade for reasons of economic freedom that you describe, because it promotes all sorts of dynamism. It is that balance that certainly strikes me as especially important. And so then I guess it goes to some extent to the question of, you know, well, if you do care about the trade balance, what are the actual policies that address it? I think you're right that exporting energy is great. Certainly we support that as well, and none of the policies that we talk about would interfere with that in any way. And I guess if we essentially have the same position on China as well, then we're not necessarily that far apart. I do want to dive in a little bit on the China question, because I think this is a really interesting place where certainly I think you would probably actually find quite severe disagreement within the signatories of your statement. And so I know, just as, you know, speaking for yourself, not at all what others might think, it strikes me that there is a tension between, on the one hand, advancing the economic freedom as you described it initially, you know, essentially people being allowed to do what they want with their own property and transact how they see fit, and on the other hand, saying, except we're not going to let you do that with China, in a sense. And so, I wonder, because I was so struck in the statement by the statement free trade with free peoples, right? Which
that was very intentional.
Well, but I guess the question is, why free peoples? In other words, let's say China were not oppressing anybody, but were pursuing its same sets of policies to steal intellectual property, restrict access to its market, subsidize its producers.
Stealing intellectual property is oppressive. I mean, I would argue it's theft.
But they'd be stealing our intellectual property, not their own people's intellectual property.
Sure, but that's still not good, right? Stealing is bad.
Oh, no, I agree, but it wouldn't violate the free people's provision.
I would disagree with that. I would say that if you are stealing my stuff, we are not having we're not engaging in free commerce, right? That's not free commerce. Free commerce is I make something, I have property, whether it's intellectual property or real property or, goods and services. I exchange that for something you have and that's a fair trade. If that's actually done fairly, fine. If you've read some of the libertarian reviews of the Freedom Conservative Statement, they complain about that, right? So the hardcore libertarians, the ones who really truly represent the people you're trying to bash on Twitter, they don't like the fact that we make this non-absolutist statement about free trade. But that was very important to us for precisely this reason, that we want to account for the fact that China has a 100-year project to basically replace the U.S., as the world's leading power, and they're willing to do anything that serves their self-interest to do so, including stealing from us, including repressing their own people. And I don't think it's going to work in the long term, because as Xi moves China to a more repressive economy, leaving aside the political repression, I think it's going to be hard for China to overtake the U.S. so long as we don't find ourselves trying to mimic China's approach to economic policy.
Yeah, interesting. No, I mean, the intellectual property one is fascinating because, of course, intellectual property itself, some would say, is an interference on free transactions.
That's a great point. And believe me, I'm attuned to that, because in the pharmaceutical industry, that's a big problem. The USPTO, the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, hands out patents like candy in at times often when there's not actual innovation happening, where somebody has made a tiny, pretty obvious modification to a pharmaceutical product and said, hey, I made this tiny little modification, this is now patented. And the USPTO kind of thoughtlessly just kind of issues these patents, and then you have a 20-year monopoly on a very expensive drug that should have been off patent and should be genericized. So this happens all the time, not just in pharmaceuticals, but across the board. And one of the things I really respect about the Biden administration is this point that the Biden administration is actually trying. They have an executive, Biden put out an executive order that says, let's look at this and let's make sure that we're offering, awarding patents, issuing patents for true innovation and not things that are obvious or trivial that end up blocking competition. And I think one area where Republicans have been frankly wrong on this is that they're listening too much to the lobbyists who say all patents are property, all patents are good. And I'm not with them on that.
Interesting. All right. Well, I want to hit a couple of the other elements of the agenda. I think you brought up the fiscal sustainability one, which is I think an incredibly important one that I'm certainly very interested in as well. And I guess what struck me about it, to your point that, look, it's principles, not policy. I think the flip side is, a principle that doesn't make any acknowledgement of trade-offs or give any direction starts to feel more like a sort of aesthetic statement than a substantive one. And so I'm curious, do you feel like, either for yourself or within the coalition that you're trying to bring together, does this represent any sort of, for instance, consensus that, we're probably going to have to both bring down spending and raise some more revenue? Or do you see the sort of absolutist thou shalt never raise taxes as consistent with freedom conservatism?
Well, again, I only speak for myself. I don't speak for anyone else, but it has literally been my entire life's work in the public policy space to try to solve this problem of making sure that my kids and your kids grow up in a solvent country. It's incredibly important. In 5 years, we're going to be spending more on interest on the federal debt than we spend on national defense. It's a complete catastrophe. This is not a problem of the far off future. It's a problem of now. We're going to be lucky if we have 20 years of runway, given the amount of debt that we're issuing and the money that we're printing to basically inflate our way out of that debt, which is itself incredibly tragic. So the problem of the deficit and the debt is incredibly important. And so I would disagree with you that simply stating the principle is cliche. It's true. I do agree with you that when it comes to Republican politicians, that's the case. There are a lot of Republican politicians talk a good game about the deficit and the debt when they're out of power. But when they're in power, the deficit and the debt just keep increasing. That's what we saw with Trump. That's how we saw with George W. Bush, et cetera, et cetera. George H.W. Bush actually contributed to reducing the deficit because he did raise taxes, to your point, and cut defense spending, or it was that it comes to the peace dividend of the Cold War. By ending the Cold War, that's how we balanced the budget in the Clinton years, not by so much increasing revenue, but by reducing spending on defense. Now defense spending is actually pretty low as a percentage of GDP. And our tax our revenue as a share of GDP has actually gone up considerably under Obama and to a lesser extent, Trump and Biden. I mean, Trump brought it down a little bit, but then Biden's brought it back up. So revenue as a share of GDP is pretty high. And so, you know, we do need to arrest the spending.
Isn't it like 17, 18%?
I think it's higher than that now. I want to say it's, I have to look at the latest CBO statistics. I don't have them at the top tip of my tongue, but it's, you know, revenue as a share of GDP, particularly when you include the state and local on top of it, it's pretty high. So the problem is not that the government doesn't tax enough. We could say there's a structural problem in the way we levy taxes that's very different from Europe. We actually have the most progressive taxing system in the OECD because we don't have a VAT. You know, most European countries pay for their welfare states and their entitlements by having a VAT of 17 to 25% on all goods and services that basically pays for everything. Progressive income taxes are relatively less of a revenue driver for most European countries than basically a national sales tax is. But we don't have that in the U.S. So we rely heavily on the income tax, which creates all sorts of distortions. It's a problem. But I would say my personal view is that the problem is spending, because the spending is growing as a share of our economic output, right? The tax revenue is relatively constant. Yes, it creeps up a little bit, creeps down a little bit, depending on who's in power, but it stays within a band. But what doesn't stay within a band is the spending. The spending as a share of GDP is skyrocketing, partly because of things like the COVID relief package and the infrastructure bill and all this other stuff. But most importantly, it's being driven by the exponential growth in spending on healthcare, government healthcare entitlements in particular. So that's why, you know, big part of the reason why I work on healthcare policy so much, because that's the most important problem we have to solve if we want to get our deficit and debt under control. And this is where I've clashed with a lot of the traditional Republicans who, again, they listen to lobbyists more than they listen to their constituents or the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office. And they say, well, you know, we can't do anything to reduce the how much we pay for healthcare, because then this pharmaceutical lobby will be mad at me, or this hospital lobby will be mad at me, or this doctor lobby will be mad at me. And, you know, if we want to solve the problem of the deficit and the debt, the most important thing we have to do is arrest the growth in government healthcare spending. And that does require trade-offs. And if you want to read all about them, go to freeapp.org and you'll see tens of thousands of words about this topic. All the detail you want.
All right. I guess one more I wanted to be sure to hit, and I think, you know, this one unsurprisingly is the sort of thing that catches lots of attention online, is the point that you guys made about race under the heading America's Promissory Note. And you have a statement, you know, quote Martin Luther King, talk about how many who descend from victims of system of slavery and segregation now face economic and personal hurdles that are the direct result of this legacy. And then you say, we commit to expanding opportunity for those who face challenges due to past government restrictions on individual and economic freedom. And I think for me anyway, the question was, and then you go on to say, but you adamantly oppose racial discrimination in all its forms.
For or against any person or group of people.
Yes.
And the point I guess being we're against both affirmative action and, traditional racial discrimination.
Right. I guess for me, what was perplexing about this one was finding a link between the two parts of the statement. Mm-hmm. That is, what is a policy that you could envision these principles arguing for which the observation about race is actually a necessary prerequisite? What work is the statement about race doing in any policy you could envision these principles supporting?
Yeah, great question. I'm glad you asked that. And I think this is one of the areas where we both depart from the 20th century conservative movement and the national conservatives. By the way, I have to ask you didn't sign the National Conservative Statement of Principles, but I always thought of you as sort of a nationalist guy. Do you not identify as a nationalist, or what led you to not sign the National Conservative Statement?
Well, first and foremost, I tend not to sign statements. I'd always rather say things in my own words. But in particular, I don't like sort of broad statements. I think, I don't remember who I commented to. I agree with most of the things in the Freedom Conservatism statement too, but I think when they're this broad, they tend to some combination of becoming more sort of atmospheric and read into how things are said than what is said, and end up either having something that offends everybody or being a kind of lowest common denominator that you can get lots of people to sign, but as a result, it's not clear what they're actually agreeing about. So, I think the work that the National Conservatism group does is very important. I've been proud to speak at their conferences, and there's a lot I like in their statement, but opted not to be a formal signatory to it.
That's helpful. So I elaborated, to answer your question, I elaborated on this point about racial equality in two different articles that I've written, which I can point your listeners to. The first in National Review, which is called Freedom Conservatism is Different and That Matters. Unfortunately, that article is behind a paywall, so I apologize for that. And there's another article on the freedomconservatism.org substack, which is titled Why I Signed the Freedom Conservatism Statement of Principles. Actually, it's reposted from the FreeOp substack, so it's in both places if you subscribe to our substack. But basically, in both of those places, I elaborated on this particular point because, again, there's only so much you can say in one paragraph, and particularly on a topic like this where you can go in a lot of different directions. So there's a couple things we're trying to say here. Number one is just core principle. We should aspire for a society where we judge each other by the content of our character, not the color of our skin, right? That's something that I think almost all of us believe. Not all of us, and there are certain people in the National Conservative Movement who are pretty explicit about not believing in that principle. But almost all of us believe that, I think. So you could say, okay, well, what's the big deal? Don't we all believe that? Or don't most of us believe that? And this is where the next part is really important, which is that it's not enough to merely oppose affirmative action and oppose racial discrimination. A lot of conservatives, let me step back. So one thing that's important about the history of the conservative movement, particularly the Buckley-Reagan conservative movement of the second half of the 20th century, is that Buckley and a number of his cohort were against the Civil Rights Act of 1964. As I write about in the Substack piece, which actually I'm quoting from another National Review piece I wrote a couple years ago, Barry Goldwater opposed the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Now, he was not a racist. He believed that then the Civil Rights Act of 1964 was too much federal interference in state affairs. But he was opposed to it. William Rehnquist and Robert Bork, who were advisors of Goldwater, advised him to oppose the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Robert Bork in 1963 wrote a very long essay in the New Republic saying that it was a principle of unsurpassed ugliness that the government would try to prevent discrimination in this way. Brent Bozell, who was Buckley's wingman in the National Review days and who ghost wrote Goldwater's book, The Conscience of a Conservative, I think chapter 4 of The Conscience of a Conservative is all about Barry Goldwater ranting about how terrible he thought the Brown v. Board of Education decision was, because he thought it was terrible. He called it judicial activism, that the Supreme Court would get rid of separate but equal. So all this to say that the big black mark of the conservative movement of the second half of the 20th century was that at the moments when it mattered, I mean, Buckley and Bork and all these guys, they regretted it afterwards and they recanted. But in the 50s and 60s, when these battles were being fought, when these debates were being fought, they were on the wrong side. And we felt, we the signatories, felt that it was very important to make a clear break from that history and say, for us, we have the opposite view. We have the view that slavery, the Goldwater Buckley view was that it was pro-freedom to allow segregation and Jim Crow, because you wouldn't want the federal government intervening in states' rights. And our view is, no, individual rights are what matter. The individual rights of a black person to stay in the hotel of his choice, or go to the gas station of his choice, or eat at the lunch counter of his choice, or rent the house of his choice. That's economic freedom, too. And we were restricting in the segregated South, but not just in the segregated South, those important elements of economic freedom. And so the challenge today is that a lot of people on the right today say, well, all that's fine, Ovik, but that's all history. That's ancient history. Now we have the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Everything's equal now. Can we just stop talking about race and just kind of forget about it? And, I sympathize with that in the sense that the woke DEI stuff, goes way too far. And I disagree with much of it, if not most of it, if not nearly all of it. But the one key point that a lot of conservatives lose in their antagonism to all that is that there is a persistence of inequality of opportunity for the descendants of the victims of slavery and segregation that derives from the structures that were erected during slavery and during Jim Crow. To give one example that I talk about in this Substack piece, why I signed the Freedom Conservatism Statement of Principles, the way people are educated in America, right? So you generally go to school where you live. And that's great in a segregated America where you can force all the black people to live in a particular place and then underfund their school. And then, if you're a segregationist, you love that system, right? And the problem is today, we got rid of segregation formally, but de facto, there are still lots of people who live in formally segregated neighborhoods who don't have the educational opportunities they ought to have because of the downstream effects of the segregated system. So how do you solve for that? So some people on the left say we have to solve for that through reverse discrimination. We say the opposite. We say let's give kids and parents more freedom. Let's allow the kids to take the money that's being spent on their behalf in these public schools that are not working and give it to them in the form of education savings accounts to get the education of their choice. That is a race-neutral policy that disproportionately benefits the people who've been denied economic opportunity, not just because of segregation, but also because of segregation. So that's an example of a policy that's race-neutral, pro-freedom, and pro-social mobility, and does a lot to address the downstream effects of the slavery and segregation of the past.
Right. I mean, I guess this strikes me as a perfect illustration, though, because let's say there had been no such thing as slavery. Presumably, you would still support education savings accounts for all the reasons you just described.
That's true, but life is about priorities. And at FreeUp, our priorities, we will literally not work on any policy idea unless it can meet two tests. Test number one, it has to result in the net expansion of liberty. So that may mean more government here and less government there, but in the end, there has to be a net expansion of liberty. And the second test it has to meet is that it has to meaningfully improve the lives of Americans whose incomes or wealth are below the U.S. median. If it doesn't meet those two tests, we won't work on it. And so, there's lots of people who are pro-freedom, but our view of where the existing pro-freedom think tanks were falling short is that they weren't prioritizing the policy areas that were disproportionately affecting Americans on the bottom half of the ladder. And that's why we felt there was a need for a new think tank that deployed the tools of free enterprise and competition innovation to solve the problems that lower and middle income Americans face.
Right. No, and I really admire that about your work, and certainly, whether we agree that on how to do it, ultimately that's what motivates so much of what we do at American Compass. I'm still left with the same question, though, which is that second part of the test about those who are lower on the income scale and expanding their opportunity, again, says nothing about race. And in fact, if there had been no history of segregation or systemic disadvantage, you would presumably still have that exact same second test and still want public policy focused on expanding opportunity for those lower down the economic ladder. So I'm still left asking, what work does the statement about race do in how anyone should think about governing or public policy?
Well, it's a little bit more complex than that, because not every single Black person in the United States today is the descendant of a victim of U.S. slavery and segregation. So about 12% of African Americans who live in the United States are first-generation immigrants. Another 8%, if I've got the statistics right, are second-generation immigrants. So that doesn't mean they might, you know, they may face discrimination in their own lives because, you know, they're dealing with this culture and this history as well. But that's very different from being somebody who, because of their grandparents not being able to open a bank account or their great-grandparents not being able to have a job, they're facing intergenerational economic challenges because of that. So that's why we're very careful in our language on that point to say, look, it's not about if you're Black, you get X. It's about if you are the descendant of a victim of slavery and segregation, the particular problems and the persistence of inequality of opportunity that is the result of that is something that, along with other challenges we face in America, like the decline of blue collar work and other things, these are challenges that we should face and we should try to do something about, not through discriminatory policies in a different direction, but through economic policies that will affect everybody, but will especially help those in these situations.
All right, I have a final question for you. As I look through the list, and this occurred to me just as we were talking, as I think about the statement of principles, and if I were to sort of choose a single figure in recent American political history who I would say best encapsulates this statement of principles, it would be George W. Bush. How does this statement of principles differ from, say, the outline for George W. Bush's second inaugural address? And what, if anything, in here would you say, if you'd brought this as a memo to the George W. Bush campaign, they would say, no, this is not what we're about?
I wouldn't agree with that assessment. I think that this is the kind of statement that someone like George W. Bush could sign. But I also think it's the kind of statement that Ron Paul could sign. I think there's a broad, I mean, the conservative movement, since it was the modern American conservative movement as founded by Bill Buckley and the fusionists between the libertarians and the social conservatives and the anti-communists in the 50s, there's always been this interplay between the tension between a purist libertarian approach, a more pragmatic conservative approach, a socially conservative approach, and in the Cold War, obviously, fighting the Soviet Union was very important. So, we drew from the Sharon Statement, which Buckley and others signed in 1960, in which, you know, the fight against Soviet communism was extremely important. Today, you and I might agree that, you know, defeating Red China, as we used to call it, is also very important. But there's obviously a broad range of views about how to do that. Some people who signed the document are very skeptical of U.S. involvement around the world, and others maybe more, have a more kind of Reaganite view of prudential involvement in things around the world. So I think there's a range of views there. And, I could see someone like George W. Bush signing this document, but I could also see, particularly when you're talking about the second inaugural, which is about his foreign policy vision, I think that there might be people in our group that agree to some degree with his vision, but I'd say probably a very small minority. I think that there's probably the plurality that are more in the Reagan end of things, which is to say a balance between realism and idealism, where we have values, we try to fight for our values where we can, but we also recognize the limits of our power and our ability to implement those values and advance them around the world. But we do try to fight for freedom and be a beacon for freedom around the world and be that shining city on a hill, as Reagan said. And then there are others who are, because of the recent experience with Iraq and Afghanistan, go far to the left of the Reagan view, you could say, from a, you know, libertarian to Reaganite perspective, or Bush, George W. Bush perspective. So I think there's a range of views there. And, you know, that's one of the areas where you might say, well, the statement is really vague and doesn't take a stand. But I personally think that's fine. Like, I think it's okay. I think foreign policy is one of those areas where prudence and judgment are very important, right? So there was always in foreign policy the challenge of saying, okay, what are the limits of our power? What are we capable of doing? What is the best use of our values and our authority? To what degree do we need to stand up for our allies? These things can be matters of judgment, and people can fall in different places. But I would say that the thrust, the plurality of the group from who I've talked to, really admire the Reagan approach, which was not, you know, we didn't go bombing the Russians, right? We fought the Russians in every other way except that, and that's a kind of prudential but also values-driven foreign policy that ultimately led to a lot of success for the United States.
Yeah, no, and I think you're certainly right about, you know, obviously the signers of any statement will have all sorts of different thoughts. But and maybe this goes back to why I don't like statements, but it strikes me that for the statement as a statement, as opposed, one could say what's valuable about the statement is the list of names, right? Here's a list of people who, in a sort of ChatGPT, deep learning sort of way, you know, we will infer from that what the coalition is. But to the extent that the statement qua statement has value on its face, one should be able to read it and take away something about what is being said about the direction of conservatism or the party. And so I would just kind of ask, and then I'll give you the last word, is there anything you would point to in it that indicates a desire to move away from the George W. Bush administration's model of governance?
So if we just go back to what the text of the statement says, and I have to pull it up here, give me a second, or you can read it if you've got it in front of you, but like let's just read it to just frame this conversation. So it says, "The shining city on a hill, American foreign policy must be judged by one criterion above all, its service to the just interests of the United States." That is a direct quote from the Sharon statement, by the way. "Americans are safest and freest in a peaceful world led by the United States, in which other nations uphold individual liberty and the sovereignty of their neighbors." So let me try to walk you through that language and why it's written in that way. So,
well, and sorry, and let me just pause. Happy to go there if you want. I'm not focusing specifically on number nine. I'm just thinking about in generally across all 10 of the principles. Is there anything in the set of 10 principles that conflicts in any way or indicates a desire to move away from what George W. Bush ran on?
I think you have to ask individual signatories, but if you ask me, what I would say is that the way we prosecuted the war on terror led to a net reduction in the freedom of Americans. Mm-hmm. And that was bad in multiple ways, both in terms of the restriction on economic freedom, the Patriot Act, while you could say well-intentioned, did a lot to restrict American economic freedom in ways that ultimately ought to be revisited. And the spending from the Iraq and Afghanistan wars was pretty substantial, increased our debt substantially. And one of the things that that I worry about a lot is if China invades Taiwan and we get drawn into a conflict about over Taiwan, with the fiscal vulnerabilities that we have, this could be like the Suez Crisis of the end of the British Empire in the 50s. I mean, we may not be able to defend Taiwan, and that's that. If we don't have these, if we don't build those fab plants in Arizona, we're going to be stuck. And by the way, this gets to a lot of the, you know, if you want to talk about industrial policy and freedom and all those other things, like if we want to not get into war over Taiwan, if we want to have high-end semiconductors built in the United States, then a big part of the problem is there are not enough people in the United States who can actually work in those plants. Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company, TSMC, is actually delaying the launch of their plant in Arizona because they don't have the skilled workforce in the United States to be able to do it. And our immigration policy doesn't allow us to bring more Taiwanese skilled laborers into the United States. So that speaks to a couple things, areas where we agree and perhaps areas where we don't. I think you and I, based on your manifesto, totally agree on the importance of migrating from the immigration system we have into one where we emphasize a skills-based system. This is not where every nationalist is, right? A lot of the nationalists want a moratorium on immigration. They want all immigration to end. And that's a terrible mistake for our economy. A skills-based system would do a lot to help American workers and advance American jobs. But the other big piece of this, when I read your manifesto, is there's a lot of talk about the decreasing power of workers. We have an economy right now with 3.5% unemployment where there are more job openings than there are workers, you know, who are looking for work. And part of that, by the way, is because we pay people not to work because of the massive expansion of welfare in this country, which also has very destructive effects for communities. Why are we having more deaths of despair? Because people aren't living productive lives. And by productive, I don't mean it in some homo economicus way. I mean in the sense of meaning, the meaning and dignity that come from being needed by others, whether it's in a family setting or an employment setting. So these problems are all connected to each other. And freedom, economic freedom, can help us address a lot of these problems. But do we need to be trying to rebuild nations across the world where they failed? Clearly, we're not good at it. Whether we should be doing it or not, we're clearly not good at it. And I think everybody understands that. And I think there are very few people today who would defend the way we prosecuted the Iraq and Afghanistan wars in that context. So the people who were critical of the Iraq and Afghanistan invasions from the beginning, or particularly the Iraq, right? The Afghanistan wasn't as controversial in 2001, but that the invasion of Iraq was more controversial, and the critics of that were right. Now, why they're right, there could be a lot of debate about, and we don't have perhaps the time to get into that. But I think the United States is going to take over Iraq and rebuild it as a free society didn't turn out very well. It turned out very badly. And that's not just a problem in the sense of just saying, you know, George W. Bush made a big mistake. It means that we also have to think about how do we live in a world where there could be more nuclear proliferation? If Iran does acquire nuclear weapons, what are we going to do? The security of the United States is going to be under threat in multiple ways as our kids grow into adults. And we've got to be thinking really hard, not just about attacking or criticizing what George W. Bush did, but thinking hard about how do we live with a nuclear Iran? How do we live with a China that wants to expand and take over territory from its neighbors? These are hard problems.
They are. We are lucky to have you working on them.
Thank you too.
Really appreciate you making the time to talk. Do you have anything we left out? Anything else to hit, or we will save it for next time?
I mean, Oren, we should do this more regularly because I think, I think there's a lot of things we agree on, a lot of things we disagree on, and that could hopefully help refine the thinking of both of us and all the people that listen to us and read our work.
That'd be great. Well, the rule is we have to be fighting about something before we can invite you on Critics Corner.
Okay.
I'm sure we'll find something to fight about soon. And until then, again, thank you very much, Ovik Roy. Check out freedomconservatism.org. This has been Critics Corner on the American Compass podcast.
Thanks, Oren.